Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee Conference is wrapping up in Washington, D.C. today. The conference usually attracts U.S. politicians from both sides of the aisle, while Democrats like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer spoke to a crowd of 18,000. Democratic presidential candidates are skipping the conference. Senator Bernie Sanders, Policy Director Josh Horton, told the Huffington Post, quote, Senator Sanders is concerned about the platform AIPAC is providing for leaders who have expressed bigotry and oppose a two-state solution, end quote. Yesterday, Senator Kamala Harris tweeted a photo of herself with AIPAC leaders from California, writing that they discussed the need for a strong U.S.-Israel alliance. Many of the speakers at AIPAC made reference to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's tweets and questions about U.S. foreign policy in Israel and AIPAC, but they did not say her name. At a recent event, Omar said, quote, I want to talk about political influence in this country that says it's okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country, end quote. This has renewed a discussion about AIPAC as an influential power player in Washington, D.C., and we will talk about that on today's show. Yesterday, Donald Trump signed an executive order officially recognizing the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. And here is a clip from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at a press conference with Donald Trump.
Mr. President, our dear friend Donald, you have shown consistently incredible support for Israel, for our right to self-defense. Israel has never had a better friend than you.
That is a clip from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with Donald Trump yesterday. Netanyahu cut his trip short and flew back to Israel after Israeli authorities said rockets fired from Gaza struck a home in Israel near Tel Aviv, injuring 7 people. Authorities said Hamas is responsible for the attack, but the group has not claimed responsibility. Israel retaliated with several airstrikes on Gaza, which injured at least 7 people and destroyed several buildings, according to reports. Last Friday, Israeli soldiers shot and killed 2 Palestinians taking part in the weekly Great March of Return protest, which began a week ago on Friday. So there's a lot to discuss. We're going to talk about AIPAC. We'll also talk about what's happening on the ground in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank and the occupied territories. Today, we are joined by MJ Rosenberg. He worked at AIPAC for 6 years, followed by 15 years on Capitol Hill as a Senate and House aide. He recently wrote about his experience working for AIPAC for the Nation, and you can find that piece at yourcallradio.org. MJ Rosenberg joins us from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Hi, MJ. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. We're also joined by Deanna Boutu, a lawyer and analyst and policy advisor for Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Deanna is also former legal advisor to the Palestine Liberation Organization, and she joins us from Ramallah. Hi, Deanna. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And before we dive in and talk about AIPAC, I'd like to give all of this a little bit of context. We had 2 people on from Gaza a couple of weeks ago talking about what has been happening with the Great March of Return protests. And Deanna, we reported that the UN said Israeli soldiers may have committed war crimes while responding to these protests. According to the UN, 189 Palestinians were killed between March 30th and December 31st of last year. What has been happening this year? We can find the news if we search for it. For example, 2 Palestinians were killed last Friday. But what is happening every Friday on the ground?
Well, every Friday, with the exception of one Friday, there have been weekly protests in which thousands of Palestinians are going to the fence area, and they are demanding both their right to return and also demanding a lifting of Israel's blockade on the Gaza Strip. In short, they're demanding their freedom. And despite the fact that we have this report by the United Nations and several condemnations from countries around the world, Israel continues to target and shoot Palestinians, killing Palestinians virtually each and every week at these protests. one of the stories that hasn't been told is not just the story of the people who've been killed, whether it's paramedics or journalists or children, etc., but the number of Palestinians who Israel has injured. And if you look at the number of Palestinians who've been injured just since the start of the protests in March of last year until the end of last year, 2018, it surpassed the number of Palestinians who were killed during the entire very brutal bombing campaign of 2014. And what this is telling us is that the Israeli army is deliberately targeting Palestinians, deliberately using force, and it's placed the medical system in such a state where it's not just Gazan hospitals, but no hospital around the world is able to cope with the number of people who have very severe injuries, including requiring amputations, with these weekly protests.
In fact, the United Nations said that Israeli forces are targeting medics who have the white jacket on and journalists. Just from the period that the UN reported on, March 30th through December 31st, Israeli forces injured 6,106 Palestinians with live ammunition. Another 3,098 were injured by bullet fragmentation, rubber-coated metal bullets, or tear gas canisters. And if you search for it, you can find videos of people who have lost limbs and are not getting the care that they need in the hospitals. In fact, when we did a show with two men from Gaza, they said that exactly what you said, that it's very difficult to get health care. MJ, can you talk about this? We're not really getting much news about what is happening every Friday. It is there if you look for it, but it's not on the front pages or in the conversations that you're hearing on most radio stations.
Well, I mean, that's, I've been involved in the Israel-Palestinian conflict, writing about the conflict and dealing with it and working on Capitol Hill and working at AIPAC. None of this is surprising to me. There is, in the media, there is essentially no interest in Palestinian deaths, whether they are on the West Bank or Gaza or Jerusalem or anywhere else. It doesn't compute. The only way that the mainstream media and Congress and et cetera, the only time that they get concerned is when Israel is widely accused, not just by the UN, which they always try to discredit, but by if the media starts saying, well, that hundreds of or dozens or whatever of Palestinians were killed, or runs a picture of children dying on the Gaza beach, and it's getting Israel bad press, then AIPAC and its allies, and including in the media, will go to work to dispute it, to prove that it didn't happen, to say that it's all, this is all, this predates the concept of fake news, but that it's all fake news. Only when a horror in Gaza or West Bank affects Israel's image and they perceive it affects Israel's image will it get coverage at all. The Palestinians count for nothing in and of themselves. That sounds cruel. I would like to see that quote from me freestanding, but you know what I mean. They really count for nothing.
Deanna, when we had Ahmed Abu Artina, one of the original organizers of the Gaza Great March of Return, on the show, along with Jihad Abu Salim, he's now here in the United States studying, and they both talked about what life is like in Gaza. Jihad, after a long time of trying to get his papers, finally was allowed to leave Gaza to study in the United States. He has not been back for 5 years to see his family because he says there's no guarantee he'd be able to leave again. I mean, that's just one example. But Ahmed and Jihad were talking about why so many young people would protest every Friday knowing that they could either lose a limb or lose their lives. So can you again tell us what life is like for Palestinians living in Gaza. They also talked about how electricity is unpredictable, clean water is unpredictable. I mean, just getting from point A to point B is incredibly difficult. I mean, these are also stories that we just don't hear much in the United States.
Yes, if you are a child who is 10 years of age or older, you've survived three attacks on Gaza, three very brutal attacks on Gaza. If you were a child who is over the age of 13 or under the age of 13, the only thing that you've ever seen your entire life is a brutal blockade that's been imposed on the Gaza Strip, which means that everything from foodstuff to construction equipment to medical supplies is completely being controlled by Israel. And if you're anywhere under the age of 25, which at this point you're talking about more than 60% of the population is under the age of 25, all that you've ever lived under is a system of Israeli control in which Israel controls each and every aspect of your life, whether that's the entry of school books or your exit, your ability to exit or enter the Gaza Strip. So these, you're talking about an entire generation that all they have ever seen is living under a very repressive Israeli regime. Now, that repressive Israeli regime means that if you need medical treatment, you have to exit the Gaza Strip. And the only way you can exit is to obtain an Israeli permit to exit. If Israel looks into your background and finds for some reason that there's somebody within your extended family that they don't like, then you're not going to be able to exit the Gaza Strip. And for a lot of cancer patients who can only get cancer treatment outside the Gaza Strip because Israel doesn't allow radiation equipment into the Gaza Strip, you know, cancer doesn't wait for an Israeli permit. Cancer continues to progress whether there's an Israeli permit or not an Israeli permit. For all of these young people, they've lived their lives without without any ability to seek freedom, with their ability to exit Gaza or enter Gaza curtailed, their ability to go out into the sea curtailed, their ability to be able to study at a university of their choice cut short, their ability to visit friends and family that may be in the West Bank or elsewhere completely cut short. So they, in effect, have been living under a system of extreme Israeli repression control. And what they're doing is they're crying for help. They're crying for the world. They're crying out to the world to give them their freedom, to let them live in freedom and dignity. And sadly, the world doesn't seem to be answering their calls.
What is life like? You're in Ramallah right now, Deanna. What is life like in the West Bank?
The West Bank differs in some respects from the Gaza Strip, but it's the same in some respects. So it's the same in that I also live under a system of Israeli military occupation, Israeli military control. The difference is that I see Israeli settlements around me. I see Israeli soldiers around me. If I want to move from one area to another area, I have to go through an Israeli checkpoint, and I can possibly do that. I can possibly go from one Palestinian city to another Palestinian city and go through an Israeli checkpoint, but have to endure Israeli settlers and Israeli soldiers along the way. The difference in the Gaza Strip is that you don't see the settlers any longer, but you definitely feel the presence of the soldiers. So the Gaza Strip is under routine bombing campaigns, as we've seen just the past few days. The Gaza Strip is under a system of siege and control, which means that the entry and exit of not only individuals, but goods and supplies is completely controlled by Israel. And so the system is very different. That being said, for both Palestinians in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, none of us are living in any form of freedom. I'm somebody who used to live in the Gaza Strip, and I still have my very fond memories of my time in Gaza, and I haven't been able to go back to Gaza for now 13 years because I've been denied an Israeli permit to be able to enter the Gaza Strip, and my friends who live in the Gaza Strip have been denied the ability to come visit me in the West Bank.
Wow, for 13 years. How far is Ramallah from Gaza?
It's about 55 miles, 80 kilometers between the two, and yet it feels like it's a world apart. It's easier for me to travel to a foreign country and to be able to get into a foreign country than it is for me to get into Gaza. As I mentioned, I haven't been able to get into the Gaza Strip since 2006.
And I also wanted to ask about what's happening with Hamas, because it seems like Palestinians. I mean, the New York Times has a piece called Hamas Crackdown on Gaza Protest Instills Fear. This was written just a couple days ago. According to this piece, Hamas security forces beat demonstrators, raided homes, and detained organizers, journalists, and participants, about 1,000 people in all. There's also articles, well, that one definitely mentioned, but there's others that are specifically focusing on Hamas targeting journalists. So can you explain what's happening there, Deanna?
Yes, yes. There have been protests against the Hamas government that's in the Gaza Strip, with people demanding that we have elections, just in the same way that there have been protests in the West Bank, with people also demanding that we have elections. In both the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, the response by the Palestinian Authority has been to crack down on Palestinians. And there's a reason for this. The reason is that, of course, I'm not at all justifying. I'm giving you the reason that they give. The reason that they give is that they say that this will lead to unrest and that it will lead to a spiraling of the security situation. In reality, what we're facing is that Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, are living under a repressive regime of Israeli occupation that's being bolstered by the governments in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And instead of the world again looking and saying it's time for Palestinians to be able to choose their own destiny, to be able to live freely, instead the world is either applauding the crackdowns, as we see in the West Bank, giving benefits to Israel, as we see is happening when it comes to Israel, or in the case of Hamas, ignoring it.
Deanna Boutu is a lawyer and analyst and a policy advisor for Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, a nonprofit whose mission is to educate and foster debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination within the framework of international law. We're also joined by MJ Rosenberg. MJ worked at AIPAC for 6 years, followed by 15 years on Capitol Hill as a Senate and a House aide. He recently wrote a piece called "This Is How AIPAC Really Works." MJ, when we started the show, you said that you're not surprised that we're not getting much news about the Great March of Return. What about what Deanna was just explaining? Why is it so hard to just have this conversation in the United States and in the media?
Well, you know, the Israel lobby has been very successful in convincing people that Gaza is no longer occupied. When the soldiers left, Israel said, "Well, that's it. Gaza is free." And just they don't now. They quibble a lot as to even whether the West Bank is occupied. But Gaza, they say, "We left. The settlers are gone." As Deanna said, there are no settlers there; just soldiers all around it. You know, Gaza is under total blockade. Air, sea, and land. And nonetheless, if you would go up to I still go around Congress, when you tell members of Congress and you refer to the occupation of Gaza, and then you say, "Well, I mean, the blockade," they say, "What are you talking about? Israel left. Israel left, and the Gazans destroyed everything." These myths that are put out are not just, they're not just, you know, propaganda for its own sake. It really is to deter the media and Congress from paying any attention. So when these things happen in Gaza in particular, the attitude is, well, they're a bunch of terrorists and they're trying to destroy Israel. And that when they have, and when people march, they're trying to march to Israel to destroy it. This is, from my 30-some years of experience, I would say the overwhelming majority of Americans. No, I should. Diminishing all the time, I have to say, but the strong majority of Americans think that when the Palestinians do anything to oppose the occupation of the West Bank or the blockade of Gaza, they are doing it as part of a process that is designed to ultimately destroy Israel. Look, I'm an American Jew. I hear it all the time. All you have, and the ignorance of members of Congress about Palestine and Palestinians is absolutely awe-inspiring. And, of course, they have all the arguments on the other side. This is not to say that the Palestinians and their lobby here and around the world don't try to do a job, but it takes courage to report about Palestine, to stand up for the Palestinians, to talk about human rights in Palestine, because the immediate response is, why are you against Israel? That's how I see it.
So, MJ, tell us about your time at AIPAC. You worked there for 6 years. What did you do there? Why did you want to work at AIPAC?
Well, originally I went there in 1973, and then I was there till 1986, but with a big interruption in the middle when I went to work on Capitol Hill, and I went back to Capitol Hill later. I went there in 1973 as a volunteer. I was right out of college, as a volunteer to help Israel secure aid after the 1973 Yom Kippur or October War, which was a colossal disaster for Israel. So as a young Jewish kid, I went there and I volunteered. So when I say 6 years, only 4 of those years was I paid. The first 2 years I was a volunteer who did it out of love for Israel.
And so talk about just your, how your views about this issue have changed over the years.
Well, I have to say that I was never hard line. I was always for the Labor Party, and that's slightly softer line, and Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres. I never when I was even at AIPAC, I was under lots of constraints because I was too liberal. But on the other hand, I always defended everything Israel did. I just framed things differently. I would say my time there really affected my views because I shared an office with the then political director of AIPAC, and I would watch him and hear him. He was sitting right next to me and making phone calls, directing campaign money to candidates that AIPAC supported, and more significantly, to defeat those that AIPAC wanted defeated. I mean, that's why I wrote that article in The Nation, because the centerpiece of the article is me rebutting from my personal experience the myth that AIPAC does all its lobbying via the art of persuasion, when I saw, and everyone knows, that it's done through giving money. One of the reasons that AIPAC at this time and for the foreseeable future will outweigh any other influence on the Middle East is because nobody gives money on this issue the way the Israel lobby does. And that disgusted me. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I mean, but I had no problem with Republicans in terms of the Democrats and the Republicans. But what bothered me was they have no interest in everyone who walks into AIPAC and all their donors, like their 20,000 people who are at this big conference in Washington, the only thing they care about is Israel. So they will give a standing ovation to Donald Trump if they think, as they do, that he's a friend of Israel. And if there's another president who has the exact opposite views on everything else, they'll give him a standing ovation. The only thing they care about is Israel. And that is the main reason that I left and ultimately evolved in my views. It's as someone who is personally, you know, personally liberal in my orientation to the world, I have a whole bunch of views on a whole bunch of issues. I'm an American. I mean, I was born here. My parents were born here. I have views on everything, and I get involved politically on everything. The AIPAC crowd, the quote-unquote Israel lobby, which I'll point to, it's important to point out, it has 100,000 members. There are 6 million American Jews. So it claims to represent all of them. It represents its members, but it is the only organization, only pro-Israel Jewish organization that's registered to lobby on the issue on Capitol Hill. So they're not all that, they don't have that wide a membership, but the perception of them is huge because the perception is backed by money. And that's subsequently I go to Capitol Hill and I'm dealing with them.
MJ, would you hold that thought? We're going to take a
quick
break.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you. Sure. That is MJ Rosenberg. He worked for AIPAC for 6 years, followed by 15 years on Capitol Hill. You can find his piece at yourcallradio.org. Deanna Butu is a lawyer, analyst, and a policy advisor for Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Gail Romasanta, co-author of Journey for Justice, The Life of Larry Itlion, an illustrated nonfiction children's book about the Filipino-American co-founder of the United Farm Workers. It's hard to believe, but this is actually the first book of its kind about Filipino-American history. That is tomorrow, and then on Thursday, we'll be joined by Nick Estes to talk about his book, Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. Today on Your Call, we are talking about the AIPAC lobbying group. According to Senate and House lobbying records, AIPAC spends $3.5 million a year lobbying federal lawmakers. And in light of the comments from Representative Ilhan Omar, AIPAC is getting a lot more attention in the media. The New York Times ran a piece recently called Is AIPAC Too Powerful? And then the Wall Street Journal ran a report showing that AIPAC raises more than $100 million a year from donors, according to tax returns. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. And, I mean, we cover this issue on a fairly regular basis, but why do you think it's so difficult to just have an honest conversation about what is happening in Israel and Palestine? Why is it so difficult? And if you have questions about AIPAC, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by MJ Rosenberg. He worked at AIPAC for 6 years, followed by 15 years on the Hill. Deanna Butu is a lawyer and an analyst and a policy advisor for Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We'll get to calls in a minute, but MJ, you wanted to finish your story about your work at AIPAC and just how your opinions have been shaped over the years.
Well, in my evolution, in my views, there was one key moment and that I always like to share was I was working for Senator Carl Levin, and it was in, I think, 1990 or something, and he asked me to draft a letter to the Secretary of State of the United States, George Shultz, which to reinstate that the policy of the United States was that the West Bank and Gaza were occupied, that the United States still supported negotiations to end their occupation. Senator Carl Levin from Michigan wrote the draft, and he changed the draft, and he got 30 other senators to sign it. And it became the lead story in the New York Times on Sunday that week. And the roof blew off our office. I can't hardly say. Thousands of phone calls, donors calling Levin and threatening him, me personally getting a call from the New York Times columnist, William Sapphire, who threatened me. He was a New York Times columnist and said that, you know, he said terrible things about how he'd make sure I'd never work again and all kinds of things that luckily didn't come true. But that, it was unbelievable. Levin felt he had to leave. It was so, the media attention was so insane and so negative. He went off to Russia on a trip, and on the following Monday, a guy from the Israeli embassy came bursting into the office, demanding to see Senator Levin, and was cursing up a storm, so that the chief of staff, who I remember his name was Gordon Kerr, had to physically throw him out. This stuff is insane. And I've worked for five other members of Congress. Most of them are loath to do anything. Levin's letter, if you read it, it's called the Letter of 30, essentially says nothing. It's the mildest, most milquetoast thing. The reason AIPAC organized its people to go, you know, to do what they did in response was, as a AIPAC lobbyist said to me at the time, thank you for doing this. It makes sure no one will ever do it again. And so if you want to know why, it's almost, that's why it's so remarkable what Congresswoman Omar is doing. It's almost like she didn't know how bad it would be, the response. Now she sees it and she stands up with it to it. But you notice that AIPAC, you even had the leading Democrats threatening these members of Congress, led by Rep. Omar, threatening them and saying that, we'll get them in a primary and that kind of thing. So it's unless you really have a death wish and you're a politician, you kind of avoid this issue unless you're saying what the AIPAC wants. I noticed that the Senator Harris,
go ahead.
I just want to mention her because she's from California. Senator Harris signed the Move On pledge that she would not go to the AIPAC conference, which she did not do. Instead, she invited the AIPAC people to her office and fell all over herself talking about how much she stands with Israel, blah, blah, blah. So I think it's all very telling.
Well, let me read from a New York Times piece, and then, Deanna, I'd love for you to comment. A piece by Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Is AIPAC Too Powerful? She writes, quote, AIPAC does not lobby on behalf of Israel. It is sensitive about being characterized as an agent of a foreign power, as Ms. Omar suggested it was during her talk in Washington. But AIPAC almost always sides with the Israeli government, no matter who's in charge. AIPAC boasts 17 regional and satellite offices, a gleaming headquarters building near the Capitol, and an annual budget so hefty that its chief executive earned more than $1 million in salary and benefits in 2016. Traveling to Israel on a trip financed by AIPAC's education arm is practically a rite of passage for freshman members of Congress. AIPAC spent $3.5 million last year on lobbying. End quote. Again, this is a piece in the New York Times by Cheryl Gay Stolberg. Deanna, when you think about AIPAC and the influence it has on U.S. foreign policy, I mean, what are your thoughts about this?
You know, they definitely have an incredible level of influence, but it's wrong to say that they aren't advocating Israel's policy. In fact, they are. You can just see with what's been happening with this current regime, this current administration, the positions that they have taken. These are all positions that Netanyahu has long been advocating, whether it's the most recent declaration that the Israeli occupied Syrian Golan Heights is now Israeli, which is illegal under international law, or the handing over of Jerusalem, the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, again against international law, or the shutting down of the PLO office in Washington D.C., the limiting of funds to UNRWA, the UN agency that deals with Palestinian refugees, the cutting off of funds to the Palestinian Authority, and so on and so forth. These are all elements that are on the Netanyahu wish list, on the Netanyahu checklist. And it's not at all coincidental that these are the positions that Trump is taking. He's taking these positions because these are positions that are being lobbied, that he's being lobbied by AIPAC and by others, by the pro-Israel lobby, to be able to take on these positions. This is not a lobby that is advocating an agenda of peace, an agenda of freedom for Palestinians, or an anti-racist agenda. This is a group that is very much lobbying, and that's in lockstep with the Israel government, that is advocating racism, that's pushing for the denial of freedom, and that's trying to change international law, and that is, quite frankly, justifying the killing of hundreds of Palestinian protesters and the wounding of thousands of them in the Gaza Strip.
Let's go to a few callers, and then we have some emails. Let's hear from Dory in San Francisco. Hi, Dory. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Hi, Diana and MJ. Two separate things that both come from an article that I want to point out. It's from the website courtsqz.com, and the headline, the name of the article, is "The Numbers Behind Ilhan Omar's AIPAC Tweet." It's from February 11th. MJ was talking about the Democrats piling on Omar after her tweet. And it's interesting, Elliot Engel, who's the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which Omar is a member, and there's been pressure from some to get her removed from it, he had the quote, "It's shocking to hear a member of Congress invoke the anti-Semitic trope of, quote, Jewish money," unquote. He's received, according to this article, $1.07 million from the pro-Israel lobby in his career, and Pelosi has received $514,000. The one thing I do want to also read from the article, which is very eye-opening, is it says the amount AIPAC has donated has been dwarfed in recent years by the mega donors Sheldon and Miriam Adelson. Quote, "Miriam is believed to be a key influence on Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, a move that most American Jews did not support. Injecting Israeli Jewish sensibilities into the American Jewish body politic is what drives a lot of what the Adelson Fund does," and that's a quote from the Times of Israel, the Israeli newspaper. "Sheldon's casino interests," that's what's made him a billionaire, "his casino interests have been advanced by the Trump administration, including lobbying the Japanese government on his behalf for a casino license," unquote.
Yeah, thank you, Dory. We actually did a show about that report about 3 or 4 months ago, and we'll find that and put a link at yourcallradio.org. And thank you for calling, Dory. We're going to get a comment in a minute. I just want to take a few more calls and emails. I should also say that's Dory Stein, who hosts Gaza Corner on KALW. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you doing? Thank you again for putting such an important topic on the airways for Americans to really understand the effects that this body, AIPAC, has had on our foreign policy and on millions of lives, actually. I'd like to put a plug in for a very important documentary that came out recently, where a Jewish underground reporter went underground into the AIPAC and to stand with Israel and a lot of these affiliated groups, and basically filmed bundling going on, illegal bundling, filmed statements by very prominent people talking directly about how Israeli policy is affecting and, according to them, favorably their position on Israel. The U.S. has never been an honest broker in a so-called two-state solution. Now what people are demanding in Palestine is a one state with equal opportunity for all, for one person, one vote, a right of return, basically democracy. And that it's very, very telling that we continue to support politicians that vote in favor of massive military budgets that literally bomb babies out of rubble. And it's very disgusting to see that.
Lisa, thank you for calling. I believe the documentary you're talking about, The Lobby, it's yes. An Al Jazeera investigation, and I'm just reading from their website right now. It exposes how the lobby influences British politics. And this is a six-month undercover investigation, and you can find this online. So thank you for calling in. Lisa brought up the two-state solution, and MJ, you just don't hear much about a two-state solution anymore.
Well, I think that's because the two-state solution is basically, well, it was the policy of the government under Prime Minister Rabin, who was assassinated by a Jewish terrorist because he supported two states. But in the years since Rabin's death, the number of settlers on the West Bank has increased so much, and it's so considered so impossible to move those people that the two-state solution does not seem all that viable. I think more and more people are talking about various configurations that you could call one state. One state meaning Israelis and Palestinians, maybe under one government with a federation, that kind of thing, which is possible, to do without moving the settlers. You in theory, you're all living together with everyone has equal rights. Everyone has the right to bring their refugees or whatever, back to Israel, Palestine. The problem is we're so far from that now. Interestingly enough, the New York Times had an op-ed doc the other day about the settlers. And they had this right-wing settler woman, young woman, so right-wing, and they asked her, what do you think the solution is? And she said, a federation. There's no other way but a federation. And I think the one-state thing is coming to the fore as the Israelis have made the two-state solution impossible by exporting so many settlers to the West Bank.
Deanna, how do you see it? Because you are in Ramallah, you live in the West Bank. As you said earlier, you have not been able to travel to Gaza for the last 13 years, which is just 55 miles from the West Bank. So, I mean, as someone who lives there and works there, in your mind, what is a solution? And why don't we hear much about a two-state solution anymore?
Well, I've long advocated that we should be focusing on one state solution, which means focusing on decolonizing, ending Israel's colonial military rule over the West Bank and over the Gaza Strip, and putting into place a system of equal rights, one person, one vote, throughout the entire territory. Now, this is, by the way, a very generous proposal on the part of Palestinians, because of the fact that this is their country and Israel's long been colonizing it. Now, the reason we don't hear about two states any longer is for a few reasons. First, it's because, as MJ said, the two state solution is dead. It died well before Rabin, but it's certainly been killed off in the ensuing years. And today, when you look at the entire country of the historic Palestine, Israel, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and of course including East Jerusalem in the West Bank, you see that there is absolutely no way to create two states, and that is not just because of the presence of the settlements, but more importantly, because there is no political will. If Israel wanted to see a Palestinian state and wanted to have Palestinians live in freedom, they would have long exited the occupied territories. But because Israel doesn't want it, and to be quite honest, the international community doesn't want it either. If they did, they would have put pressure on Israel to also evacuate. This is why we don't see two states any longer. There still is, among the international diplomatic community, a constant talking about the two-state solution, the need for a two-state solution. The big problem is that none of these countries are willing to put any sanctions on Israel, to hold Israel accountable, to make that two-state solution come into place. And instead, what we have is a system of apartheid. And what we need to be doing is focusing on dismantling and ending that apartheid, just in the same way that we focused on dismantling and ending apartheid in South Africa. We have to work on focusing on ending and dismantling apartheid in Israel.
Deanna Boutu is a policy advisor for Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. MJ Rosenberg worked at AIPAC for 6 years, followed by 15 years on the Hill. We have time for a couple more calls. Let's go to Steve in San Francisco. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
Do we have Steve?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Hi, go ahead. Yes.
Hey, I'm going to just keep it short. I'm embarrassed to even be listening to such a shameful show. There's no other perspective besides this very, very monolithic perspective that both of your guests are proposing. And the Israeli government and the Israeli people is not a monolithic force. Within that country, there's many different perspectives, some of which don't agree with what's going on. And to hear this kind of slam piece go on NPR is embarrassing. I'll take my comments off the air.
But. Wait, Steve, wait. Can I keep you on the air for a minute? So earlier, MJ said exactly what you said. This is not a monolith. I mean, you know, American Jews have very different views on these issues. So can you be
specific
about...
So where are
about,
those views? Because I'm not hearing them on this show. I'm not hearing that
okay.
at all.
So can you tell me what you heard on the show that you know, made you call in? And then let's talk about it with our guests.
Well, I mean, let's just take the last statement. It's... I'm sorry, your female guest. Excuse me, I can't remember her name, but
Diana.
Yeah, it's their country. It's not the Israelis. The right of return. I mean, what are we really talking about here? How is this rhetoric fuel any kind of resolution? I don't see it.
All right. Hold that thought. Let's have a dialogue. And if you have another question, I want to bring you back. Diana, what would you say to Steve about that one?
Yeah. So you know, my parents were born in Palestine. And were raised in Palestine, and portions of my father's family were ethnically cleansed from Palestine. I'll give you an example of my aunt. She was born in Palestine. She was raised in Palestine. She got married in Palestine. She had her first child in Palestine. And in 1948, she was forced to flee. She ended up dying in Jordan in a refugee camp, even though she was born here, raised here, married here, and had her first child here. And the only reason that she was not allowed to return was because she's not Jewish. Now, if we're looking at solutions, which is the way that I like to view things and looking forward, I don't think that we can ignore her rights. And I don't think that we can say to her, just go away, pretend as though you weren't born in Palestine, you weren't raised here, you didn't get married here, you didn't have your first child here. Instead, we have to bring her and others like her and the millions of Palestinians who are refugees into being part of the solution rather than viewing them as the problem. The problem is the racism that is saying that they do not have rights. And the solution is to bring them in and to recognize that they do have rights, acknowledge it, and let them return. In so doing, we end up addressing the problem rather than ignoring the problem. And so when I say that it's a very generous issue to have a one-state settlement, we are talking about people who are living here, all of the people who are living here, living under a system of equality rather than a system in which there is Jewish supremacy, in which one group is preferred over another. And I don't see what's wrong with that. In fact, I think that's a very generous and very optimal solution rather than one that is going to create more harm.
Steve, are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
what are your thoughts?
I'm not arguing with any of that because that's way too much to respond to. But my great grandfather was emigrated to Palestine at that point in 1880. My family's been there that whole time. So
yeah, and I'm not denying
about but rather than having a spat about whose country it is, which is reductive and demeans the sufferings of all the people that are there, Palestinians and Israelis included, there needs to be a resolution. And I don't have the answer for what that resolution is, but I expected a more nuanced conversation from NPR. And I agree that it is inherently racist, and I think fighting over a piece of land the size of New Jersey is incredibly stupid, and there needs to be a resolution that's peaceful. But I don't really see how this conversation serves anything besides as an Israeli hit piece. So that's my perspective.
Well, I'm sorry you feel that way, Steve, but I'm glad you called in because this conversation, dialogue between you and Diana is very important. Diana, what's your response?
I'm saying the same response, which is to say that what I'm looking for is a way that's actually going to resolve resolve issues rather than create more issue, rather than create more problems. And the fact that he may not like that we bring up the issue of Palestinian refugees isn't going to make Palestinian refugees go away. Instead, I think we have to come to a space and recognize that what is fueling the fact that Palestinian refugees cannot come back, cannot return to their homes, is racism. And we need to start addressing that racism.
Deanna, how often are you invited to come on to U.S. media to talk about these issues?
It's usually when there is something where an Israeli life has been taken, then that's the time where, or when I'm most often called to speak. But apart from that, there are some journalists who are genuinely interested in knowing and what's happening here. But as MJ said, the coverage tends to focus on the other way around, rather than focusing on the day-to-day, what life is like living under Israeli military rule, what it's like living under Israeli apartheid and racism. Instead, the question, the focus tends to be mostly on when there is something that is Israeli. So whether it's an Israeli casualty or whether it's a mass number of Palestinians that are being killed by Israel, and it's, as MJ said, you're made to look bad. That's when the focus tends to be on what's happening.
Deanna Bhutu is a lawyer and analyst and policy advisor for Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. It's a nonprofit whose mission is to educate and foster debate on Palestinian human rights. MJ Rosenberg worked at AIPAC for 6 years, followed by 15 years on The Hill. Deanna and MJ, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.